Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Defence Authorisation Bill that the President has threatened to veto, with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff and went public with his knowledge of torture approved by the Bush administration. We'll look into provisions in the bill that appear to increase the role of Guantanamo Bay rather than close the place that has become synonymous with torture, as well as provisions that allow for American citizens to be arrested on U.S. soil and be held indefinitely without trial. We'll also look into other aspects of the bill that appear to make a war with Iran very likely and drive up the price of oil in an election year. Then we'll look into rumors swirling around in Venezuela that Hugo Chavez is close to death. Javier Corrales, a professor of political science at Amherst College and author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us. With presidential elections scheduled for October of next year, we'll examine the likelihood that the terminally ill leader will not run. But without any clear succession in place, the possibility of civil unrest looms. Then finally, we'll explore the role of student debt in the Occupy movement with Andrew Ross, who's a professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU and one of the organizers of the Occupy student debt campaign. With student debt reaching $1 trillion this year and the White House apparently buckling under pressure from well-connected lobbyists representing the for-profit colleges, reform of a $30 billion predatory industry that more often than not provides students with a worthless education while saddling them with a mountain of debt is not likely, thanks to the industry's friends on Capitol Hill who are allowed to make enormous profits as private enterprises that are 90% funded by the taxpayer. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was retired from the United States Army as a colonel and formerly was Chief of Staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He also serves as a Deputy Director and Director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And in 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And it does seem extraordinary that the very place that President Obama, candidate Obama in the election campaign of 2008, said he wanted to close Guantanamo, which has become synonymous with torture. And of course, the most egregious aspect of that is that the world's unsavory dictators like Gaddafi and Mugabe and now Assad in Syria are now able to say, well, you know, why are you complaining about torture? The Americans do it. It's been a terrible blow to the United States, but in this defense authorization bill, it feels like instead of closing Guantanamo, it's going to come back with more business than usual.
It is a strange development, and the most bizarre aspect of it, as I followed the debate on the Hill in the Congress, was the Congress's acquiescence in it. As a matter of fact, I was on the Hill last week speaking with a Republican congressman whose views I respect, and he said he couldn't believe what was happening. He simply couldn't believe that, in his words, only six members of a 535-member body actually registered any objections to this aspect of the NDAA, which, for all practical purposes, destroys Posse Comitatus, which is the law, of course, that keeps the United States Armed Forces from interfering with law enforcement or with anything in the domestic arena, and takes us back to the days of Reconstruction, when we put Northern soldiers in the South and essentially ruled the South. This is not the way we should be going.
Well, how did this happen, though, given that the other provisions, particularly the provisions in the bill that I think are likely to make or could make war with Iran much more likely and therefore drive up the price of oil in an election year, which you think would be completely counterintuitive for the Democrats? Why did so many Democrats in the Senate support aspects of these bills?
This is a train, I think, that once it gets moving, and I call it the national security train, once it gets moving and politicians on both sides of the aisle begin to vie with each other for being more aggressive than the other, it loses all sense of reality and sanity. We will find the president saying things like he did the other day, which just blew me over, essentially bragging about having killed bin Laden in order to contest a claim on the opposition side that he was an appeaser. This is the kind of thing that happens in Washington. This is the kind of thing that gets us in deep, deep trouble fast when these two sides, without any restraints whatsoever, begin to try to outdo each other in terms of national security for purely political gain. The White House does it with this president, I think, with the almost arrogant assumption that at the end of the day they can control it. I think they're going to find out differently. I think we're on an inexorable march to war with Iran, just as we were in, say, 2001 and 2 toward war with Iraq. It seems to me now that we're just going there.
Well, isn't there a game going on here, though, Colonel Wilkerson, in as much as there have been rumors for some time and threats, and many of the top intelligence officials in Israel went public, the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, former chief of staff of the military. I mean, you can't get more senior people going public saying that they were concerned that Netanyahu was going to attack Iran. What appears to be happening behind the scenes is that everybody is sort of trying to stop Israel from attacking Iran because of the terrible consequences. But my assumption in return is the Israelis are saying, okay, if you don't want us to do this, then either you have to do it or you and the Saudis have to do it. And isn't there kind of a Cold War going on here that at the end of the day may be a psychological operation to force the U.S. And the West to have greater sanctions because war is a catastrophe, right?
I think it is. I can paint a pretty catastrophic picture for what might result from yet another use in Western Asia of U.S. military force in an overt fashion that eventually would call on, I would guess, somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 U.S. forces, depending on how many of our allies we could get to go in with us, because you're not going to do anything with bombs. All you're going to do is irritate the people on the ground with the bombs and make them work faster. So ultimately, if you want to bring positive results, if that's even possible, you want to put troops on the ground. And in a country the size of Iran, with the population of Iran, you're talking about at least 500,000. Incidentally, you're also talking about bringing back the draft, because there is absolutely no way we could get 500,000 men and women under arms to mount the Arabian and Persian peninsula and conduct this kind of a conflict, which will take at least a decade, maybe longer, without that number of troops. We can't do it volunteer-wise. So think about conscription coming back. Every American citizen from San Francisco to New York should be considering that right now, because that's what we're talking about if we start yet another war in Western Asia. But there's a sober view back here on both sides of the aisle again that this is all rhetoric, and it's rhetoric designed to bring the Iranians eventually to the negotiating table with a better, if you will, disposition to agree to our terms. If you know anything about the Persians, you know anything about Tehran, modern history, ancient history, this is exactly the opposite of the way we should be operating, but no one's going to accuse the United States, especially its diplomats, of late, of having any real sense of the, quote, enemy, unquote, that they happen to be opposing. But this is what we feel back here. We feel these two sides of the coin, the one that says sober, sane attempt to force Iran to a better negotiating position once we ultimately get to negotiating, and we won't go to war. As I said before, this, as soon as you can control this process, I don't think you can. I think we're walking down the road to another use of military force that, like the one in Iraq, we will search historians, academics, forever for a national security decision document that says George W. Bush decided on war with Iraq. There is no such document. There is only the inexorable march to war. We're going to be seeing the same thing, I think, with Iran.
So, Colonel Wilkerson, I'm afraid that the phone connection is awfully bad here today with you. I'm just wondering if with any way we can call back or try a different line, or should we do that, or do a quick recall in case we get a better connection?
You can certainly try a call back.
We'll do it right away, because we obviously we don't want to keep our audience waiting.
Okay.
Okay. Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Are you there, Colonel Wilkerson?
Is this better?
Yeah, oh, much, much better.
Okay.
You've made a very clear case how dire the consequences are for an attack on Iran, and also how counterintuitive is our dealings with Iran by pushing them to the wall. And this bill does that. And it has the support, I believe, of something like 96 to 5 senators. It's an I don't see how the president can override. I mean, how he can sustain a veto. But we've also had the examples of the sacking of the British embassy by the Basiji militia, the religious police of the Iranian regime. And there are a lot of speculations now as the U.S. gets out of Iraq that some of the Iranian militias there in Iraq could go after the Green Zone or go after the consulate in Basra. Do you think that that there's a possibility that not just on the U.S. side provoking it, but a paranoid regime in Iran feeling threatened could strike out?
I do think that's a possibility. I particularly think it's a possibility with the IRGC in its capacity to direct elements of Iranian naval forces and the proximity of forces in the northern Indian Ocean. I'm praying that our commanders in the northern Indian Ocean, Marine Amphibious Task Forces, battle groups, and so forth, are instructed with ROE, or at least have developed their own rules of engagement that will allow them to back away from such a move and not get something started a la Tonkin Gulf or something like that. You could conceive of an IRGC commander or someone like that starting something without even instructions from Tehran. So just the proximity of forces, especially at sea, is a dangerous thing.
So what explains then, you were saying earlier that that there's a kind of fever going there on Capitol Hill, but the margin of 96 to 4 or something that voted for that particular amendment on putting the squeeze on Iran, there's no way the president can sustain a veto. He's apparently taking personal participation in these negotiations.
My understanding that with regard to the amendment we were talking about that allows the armed forces into essentially domestic law enforcement as long as it's related to terrorism or, quote, associated activities, unquote, that the reason that got applied to domestic situations, to U.S. citizens, in other words, is because of the White House. Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, actually was puzzled that when they had pulled the language out that would make it apply to U.S. citizens, very purposefully so, the White House insisted on the language going back in. So this is not only apparently something the White House won't veto, it's something that they made as bizarre as anything could be, in my view, putting the armed forces of the United States into a domestic role in terms of terrorism or associated activities. This borders on just short of declaring martial law for things related to terrorism.
But the military don't want this role, my understanding is.
That would be my strong understanding. The military already is roiling under its additional roles, which should be being done by civilian agencies, such as training police in foreign countries, such as holding military tribunals for people who should be in the Article III courts of this country. The military doesn't want these additional tasks. We're very fortunate that we have in the military people who understand the civil-military relationship in this country and the necessity for the military to stay subordinate in that relationship better than the rest of the country does. You won't find 10 people, if you go ask across the country, what is the civil-military relationship in the United States, who can give you a satisfactory answer. But you'll find almost every officer in the armed forces can. So we're very fortunate that we have an armed force like that. But we're pushing them. We're pushing them towards being different, and that's dangerous.
Well, some of the reporting suggested that the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, was involved in these negotiations. That's very, very puzzling, and it's the White House that wanted these provisions in. What is the White House threatening to veto over then? Is it the Iranian aspect of it?
That's my understanding.
So we have a president who's a constitutional lawyer, and he doesn't see the danger of eating away at the posse comitatus, and
I've known a lot of lawyers advising the government of the United States in whatever guise, who knew the law inside and out. But in terms of understanding, wisdom, I might say, they possess none. I hope that's not the case with this president, but I must say that some of the things he's done, like increasing by tenfold the amount of times his Justice Department has used the national security argument in the Article III courts, like saying he's unable to close Guantanamo when closing Guantanamo would be simple as pie, like saying that we are actually moving towards a successful conclusion in Afghanistan. That's a total fabrication. But I can't believe that he's lying. He's simply being badly advised. And if you're being badly advised, you better be awfully smart to detect that sort of thing. He's smart technically, but I'm not sure he's smart in what I would call experiential ways. That is to say, he ain't been there and he ain't done it. So he hasn't got any idea when generals talk to him about Afghanistan, when they talk to him about the situation in Iraq or whatever. He's got no idea how to challenge them. And frankly, with Jim Jones gone and Tom Donilon in as national security advisor, he's got no one to help him.
But doesn't he want to get out of Afghanistan? And the long and the short of it is, there's no way to win that thing, is there? I mean,
no way at all in the traditional sense, and there's every way in the traditional sense to lose it. Not just blood and treasure expended for almost nothing, but at any moment we could see this sort of peripheral activity that's taking place now that created so many casualties in the last 96 hours or so turn into a really vicious civil war on the one hand between the Pashtuns and everybody else, and turn into a free-for-all with groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and a host of others who are trying to grow up and fill al-Qaeda's shoes. So this could really turn into a mess, incidentally, that is right now strategically so unsound that it makes you just sit there and bite your nails. What do I mean by that? I mean that all of our logistics coming into that landlocked country are through someone else's auspices. If those someone else's, the Russians, the Pakistanis, or whomever, decide, as they have from time to time, that they want to stop those logistics, they could cut us off, and everybody we have in Afghanistan would be suddenly bound and determined to succeed only through airlift. And frankly, we don't have enough airlift without flying the wings off our C-5s, our C-17s, and everything else to carry out that kind of a Berlin airlift sort of operation with regard to all the troops we have, coalition and otherwise, NATO and otherwise, in Afghanistan. So this is a very untenable strategic situation, as well as being one that is not winnable.
So there's obviously an element of schadenfreude here. The Pakistanis hate us,
polls show about 90% of the Pakistan population, particularly in the federally administered tribal areas, the border area, 90%+ think they're number one enemies of the United States of America.
But doesn't that all of this sort of say we have to cut our losses? I don't see a way out of this. Do you?
Nope. I would have come home yesterday.
Right. Well, look, we could talk a lot more, and I'm glad you've been able to join us here, Colonel Wilkerson. And I'm sorry that the line wasn't so good at the beginning, but the long and the short of it is this is a moment for American citizens to wake up.
I'm reminded of Eisenhower's prescient speech in 1961, but not so much the military-industrial complex part, but the part where he says only a knowledgeable and alert citizenry. Only a knowledgeable and alert citizenry can take care of this, you know, all the problems he'd outlined. Well, those problems are just manifest today in ways not even he dreamed of. And do we have an alert and knowledgeable citizenry? Do we even have a media that can perform that task? These are dangerous times, in my view.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Colonel Wilkerson. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired U.S. Army colonel, former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He also serves as deputy director and director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And in 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the terminally ill Hugo Chavez and what may follow his death.
This city, let's run by pigs. They take away the rights from all the kids. I walk down the street. With a